Okay, everybody hear me all right? All right, what we're doing is we're going to have a presentation of basically the history, how I got involved in it, when I got involved and what I'm doing now. It's going to be kind of redundant for quite a few of you people who know about me and have seen the videotapes before, but I'll try to bring you up to date as to what's happening now, what's going on, why it's going on. I also am going to give you a lot of names, companies that I worked with, specifics that I didn't give you when I was down here in 1995. Jim said today that one man told him I was a hell of a good used car salesman. And I really, that bothered me. I don't know who the gentleman is, but I invite him to give me a call. He can get the number off the end of the tape, but I'd like to understand where he came up with that concept. I know you can't please everybody, but I do try anyway. My name is David Hudson. I was born June 25th, 1947. You ask why I give you that. There's a lot of people who want to do my horoscope, want to know who I am, where, when I was born and everything. So I was born in Phoenix, Arizona, downtown Phoenix, June 25th, 1947. I was very active in school, was in second grade. I was advanced to reading classes, accelerated classes all through school. I graduated from Levine Grade School as the valedictorian. I graduated from Tolleson High School as the salutatorian. I would have been valedictorian because I got straight A's, but they had me the freshman year in advanced class, and I didn't like the advanced class in English, so I transferred back to regular English, and they don't give anything but a B in regular English, because all the advanced students are in the advanced class. They got the A's. So by being in the regular class, even though I was the best student in the class, I only got a B in that class. So I got one B, all the rest were A's, so I was salutatorian, not valedictorian. I was actually known in high school as the brain. I don't really understand it, but I didn't really have to do much studying in school. I was able to pick up most of the information in school just by sitting in class. I never took books home. I consider it real fortunate that I was able to do this because I didn't really much care to do homework. I did real well that I got into college. And I found out that in college, you actually take classes where you don't have the same teacher giving the test as the teacher that taught you every day. Now, you all know what I'm talking about, how this works. You're in small grade school, small high school, you had the same teacher giving you a test that taught you. But now I'm in college, and there's like 2,200 students in chemistry class listening to the lectures in three or four different auditoriums, but when you have the test, they have graduate students in administering the test. Well, one of the things I kind of took for granted that I didn't realize is that if I had a question I didn't know the answer to, I could ask the teacher to read me the question. And when the teacher read me the question, then I could tell you what the answer was. The only thing is, when you have a graduate student giving you the test, the graduate student doesn't know the answer, and so when he reads the question to you, you don't know the answer. And I considered this for a long time and realized, you know, how I was doing it. I just believe it comes down to being very sensitive to other people, okay? When the teacher read me the question, the teacher always thought the answer when they read the question. And when they thought the answer, then I could tell you what the answer was. I don't know if anybody else, you know, has this capability or, you know, understanding, but anyway, it worked for me for a long time. I went through college at University of Arizona on scholarship for 2 years. Then I came up to Arizona State University where I graduated in pre-law. It was my intention to go into law school and become a lawyer. But during my stay in ASU, there was a girl that I really had this bad crush on. I'd had it since high school. And just couldn't get out of my system. And so, you know, one thing led to another, and I finally had to get married. And I says, you know, I'll just go ahead and go into farming like my father and rather than go into law. So I graduated in 1968 from ASU and with a bachelor's degree and decided, well, I'm going to go into agriculture like my father. My father was the Arizona State Commissioner of Agriculture in the state of Arizona. These are the guys that oversee the administration of these check stations. When you go into the state of Arizona, they check for fruits and vegetables and all in your car. Anyway, he was the big shot in that for a long time. It was just a political payoff. He was very active in Goldwater politics during the early 1960s. And this leads me to have to say that my background is I'm a very ultra-conservative right-wing John Birch background conservative. Okay, a typical Barry Goldwater conservative who believes in free enterprise system, who believes that if you're not succeeding, you're just not working hard enough. And this is a real nice system that works well given the nature of mankind like he is today. The general nature of mankind is he's selfish. And he looks out for himself. And so when all the smoke clears, there's a lot of things wrong with the free enterprise system, but in fact it does work better than any other system we've found. And the Soviets can tell us about the benefits of socialism, but in fact, you know, it didn't work nearly as well as capitalism does. Even our poor are much better off than many of the foreign countries that we're involved with. Anyway, I was extensively involved in agriculture. I started out with nothing. The equipment and all that we started farming with, I purchased from my father on a contract and paid him for. I got absolutely no real estate from him at all, and we began custom farming. Fortunately, it was the early 1960s, and things were going quite well. By the end of the 60s, we had begun to acquire property and real estate in the Phoenix area, and into the 70s, I got to farming down at Agua Caliente, which was west of Phoenix now, about halfway to Yuma, out in the desert. And we had three wells on the farm that were very, very hot. They were coming from a volcanic aquifer under the farm. And the farm also had a lot of salt on the soils, and we had some fields that had lots of black alkali in them. And I became extensively involved in water analysis, coming to understand how a well can be a good well and have lots of salt and be a bad well and not have much salt at all, which is not what normally you think. You assume if there's lots of salt, there's a problem with it. Well, it all comes down to the sodium-calcium ratio in the water. And so you can have lots of salt, but if the sodium-calcium ratio is about 3-1 or better, everything's fine because the salt you're putting on is leaching on through, and so, you know, it's not a problem. In fact, salts are beneficial to plants. But if you have a bad sodium-calcium ratio in your water, it actually can be low of salt, but be very sorry water to raise crops with, which I didn't know until I got involved in that farm in Agua Caliente. We also got involved in treating our soils with sulfuric acid. And I had no regard for chemistry. I hated chemistry in school. Didn't like to, because they had to do a lot of studying on chemistry. You had to take the book home. And I hated chemistry. A lot of memorization and, you know, just a lot of work. So it was my favorite school, this class in school. Anyway, when I got involved in this, in the putting the sulfuric acid on our soils, we were putting as much as 60 tons the acre. Actually, 30 tons was the capability machine, and we actually double applied it on some areas of the field. So we had a total of 60 tons the acre of 93% sulfuric acid. Now, that's a lot of acid, okay? And actually, when we put it on our soil was all plowed and flat and nothing growing. We come and inject it on 6-inch ribbons in the field. And this sulfuric acid would just be in the ground but not reacting because there wasn't any moisture to speak of in our soil. You remember, we're Arizona, and it doesn't rain in Arizona that much. Anyway, when we started our pumps and put irrigation water on the field, as the water ran across the field, the soil actually would froth and hiss and boil ahead of the water because the water is hitting it. It really was impressive to watch coming across the field, the water wave coming across the field, and just seeing the soil rumble and fizz and bubble as it came across the field. But what happened is the high sodium content in the soil was actually becoming sodium sulfate. Okay? The sodium is called black alkali, but as sodium sulfate, it's now called white alkali. And the difference being, sodium sulfate, by being white alkali, is leachable. It will leach out of your soil. The black alkali sodium was like grease. The soil was brown and wouldn't take water. It wouldn't absorb water, and it wouldn't give water to any plant that grew in it. By putting the sulfuric acid in there, we got white alkali. The total salt content went up because we had more salt than we had before, total salt, but it was now water leachable. So within 2 to 3 years, our soil was actually leached of the sodium, and the spots that wouldn't grow anything started growing good crops. Anyway, One of the problems in doing this is that when you put sulfuric acid on your ground, you must have a buffer in the soil. Something will buffer the acidity of the sulfuric acid. Because in addition to sulfate, you get the hydrogen ion, lots of hydrogen ions, and it acidifies your ground. Well, if you don't have a buffering material in your soil, then it drops your pH, and by dropping the pH to 3 or 4 or 5, then nothing will grow. Or at least the crops we grow in Arizona wouldn't grow on the ground. Cotton would get up about 4 inches, 5 inches tall, and it stunk, wouldn't grow anymore. But if you had lots of buffering substance, like caliche, calcium carbonate in your soil, then it would buffer the pH. The pH stayed around 7 to 8, and everything did really great, really grew well. So I became extensively involved in doing soils analysis, and I became very involved in water analysis. And therefore, I was in the laboratory paying for these analyses all the time. You know, could you do some soil analysis for me? Now, would you do it after the sulfuric acid treatment? Now, would you do it on this field? I haven't treated yet. Are you sure it's okay to treat it? And let's analyze all the areas of the field to be sure it's okay. We aren't going to create problems in the field. And I got really extensively involved in chemical analysis. Okay. About this time, and we're talking about probably about 1975 right now, in analyzing our soils, then I got involved in the water analysis. I also got involved with some people who were in mining in the Phoenix area. A fellow by the name of Jay Wilson, an old-time fellow. And he had a bunch of Appaloosa horses. And I was raising lots of alfalfa hay. I had about 3,000 acres of alfalfa hay by then. And he wanted me to bring him loads of hay all the time and give to him so he could feed his horses. He says, Dave, if you'll do that, I'll do fire assay work for you. And I said, what's fire assay work? He said, well, we can determine precious metal content for you if you want to fire assay. I said, well, I never thought about doing precious metal analysis. He said, well, precious metals really, Dave, are all over the state of Arizona. They're very common, but nobody understands them. I said, really? I said, this is 1975. You know, this is a time we have machines analyzed down to parts per billion, or so we're told. And he says, well, all I can tell you is these elements nobody can analyze for. I said, gosh, that's really interesting. I said, you sure? He said, yeah, I'm sure. So he explained to me how he was doing a heap leach cyanide project. We actually put the crumbled up ore rock out on this pad. They put this plastic pad down, put all this rock on top of this pad, and they put these rainbird sprinklers all over the rock. And then they would get this solution of cyanide made up, and they spray it over the rocks, and it would trickle down to the plastic, and then run down the plastic, and out to the rocks, and out into the settling pond, and they'd pump it back over again. It would go back, and it'd keep going round and round over these rocks. Well, curiously enough, the cyanide reacts with gold. And so gold that's in the rocks will dissolve with the sodium cyanide, and it forms gold cyanate that then comes out in the aqueous solution. And after you do this for a while, the gold actually gets in the solution. Then you can take activated charcoal, put it in like a 55-gallon drum, put hose connections top and bottom where you run the solution up through the activated charcoal, and the activated charcoal will stick to the gold ion. And so the gold cyanate actually goes to the charcoal, and you get gold stuck on the carbon. Now, a lot of you people are shaking your head, yeah, we're familiar with this. Well, you've been involved in mining or been around some miners if you've heard of this. Anyway, this heap leach cyanide process is practiced basically all over the United States and Mexico on mainly tailings operations for mining operations. But when we took this activated charcoal and stripped it of the gold and then took it to Jay Wilson to fire assay for us, you know, he was getting, you know, tremendous gold buttons off this activated charcoal. So I took some of the charcoal down to our farm at Agua Caliente and put in the hot water wells. Now, these wells were about 118 degrees coming out of the ground, Fahrenheit. Now, that's hot. 118 degrees is hot. If you jump in it, you'll only be there a few seconds. You'll come back out. It isn't very refreshing when you get in that water. It's hot. And that's coming out of the well. It's that temperature. So you know it's close to a volcanic source. Anyway, by putting the activated charcoal in just a nylon sack and setting it down in a ditch and letting the water run through the activated charcoal, let it run for 4 or 5 days, pulled the sack out, stripped it, and took it in. And by golly, we did a fire assay on it. We also got a bead. said, gee, there's precious elements in our irrigation wells. The only problem was this precious metal bead, and there should be only precious metal in the fire assay, but the precious metal bead wasn't humped up like gold or silver. It was flat and brittle and hard. And I says, well, what's that? It's not silver and it's not gold. What is it? He said, well, that's the platinum group elements. And I said, what are you talking about, platinum group elements? He said, well, the platinum group elements, you know, they're on the periodic table. And I said, look, I know what platinum is, but I never heard of a platinum group. And he said, no, there's a platinum group. He said, look on the periodic table. You'll actually find ruthenium, you know, there's ruthenium, rhodium, palladium, osmium, iridium, and platinum. And all six of those elements are called the platinum group elements. I didn't know this. He said, it's like Kleenex. You know, he said, give me a Kleenex, but you really mean give me a Delphi. Well, people say platinum group, but it's really they're talking about all the elements at the same time. I said, well, gee, that's interesting. Didn't know that. I said, why isn't there anything written about this in the books? He said, well, they're very rare. They don't occur in any quantities anywhere in the United States, so nobody writes about them. They just don't. You'll never encounter it in normal work or analysis. So I said, well, gee, you know, why don't I just take this bead to a laboratory and have them confirm what it is? Well, I took it around the Phoenix area to different laboratories, and they said, well, there was iron and aluminum and silica and all this stuff that made no sense at all because it couldn't have gone through a fire assay and been there in any quantity. But they didn't report any platinum group elements. And I said, look, you know, you sure this fire assay is being done right? He said, Dave, I guarantee it. I'll do it exactly the way it should be done, and that is platinum group elements. You just can't read it on any machine. I said, wait a minute. This is 1975, and you're telling me I have pure, or basically pure, 98% pure platinum group elements, and nobody can tell me they're there? He said, that's what I'm telling you. He said, I'll tell you, Dave, my advice to you is just walk away from it. Let it lay. He said, there are people who got on this path of trying to prove there's platinum group elements in the southwestern United States. And they end up mortgaging their home. They're putting their business in jeopardy. Everything goes in hock, and they eventually end up losing it all, and they still don't produce any platinum group elements. Well, it's my personality, people, that when you tell me I can't do something, I gotta try it. If you don't want me to do something, tell me I can't do it. And by golly, we'll see about that. Now, I may tell you it's not worth it. I may tell you I don't want to do it. But don't tell me I can't. I choose not to. I prefer not to. But don't tell me I can't. It really doesn't go down well with me. I really get bent out of shape. So I had to try. And he said, well, Dave, if you're going to commit to this, he said, I do have a book here that I want you to see. He brought out this hardbound book about this thick. It's called The Analytical Chemistry of the Platinum Group Elements. And the main author is Ginsberg, G-I-N-Z-B-E-R-G, Ginsberg. It was published by the Soviet Academy of Sciences, translated into English by the Israeli Program for Scientific Translations. Now, this book is pretty tough to find. Most good libraries do have it in the library, but it's really tough to get a hold of. Only way I could get it is to write to the Israeli Program for Scientific Translations, where they translated it into English and asked for it, and they were able to get it for me. John Wiley & Sons in New York was the distributor in the United States, but I understand he doesn't have it anymore. They don't carry it. Anyway, it's a tough book to get. It's about this thick, and every sentence is backed up by 1 to 2 footnotes and reference where the information came from. So it's a compilation of research work done all over the world, and it was assembled together by the Soviet Academy of Sciences. Now, this is the most prestigious scientific body in the Soviet Union. It's like the United States Academy of Sciences. You know, you don't get in it unless you're a pretty prestigious scientist. And there was so much information there, it was mind-boggling. And it was all technical information. And so I finally went to the spectroscopic section. I said, well, we're going to address this first of all, the machine itself. And in this book, under emission spectroscopy, it gives a general procedure that will always work for analyzing any platinum group elements. And the procedure said that you build a machine using carbon electrodes. And for those of you who don't know what emission spec is, they have one electrode here shaped like my finger with a little cup in the top of it. And you put your sample that you want to analyze, this powder, in the electrode so it sits on top. And they lower another electrode down right above it. And then this machine has optics with a lens here beside it that goes in the machine, breaks the light frequencies up into their different spectra, and they create the various spectra, or it's the fingerprint of the element. And every element has a different fingerprint, different light spectra. And this is all recorded on this great big arc in the machine with all these slits in it to measure the light coming at specific frequencies. Anyway, I will show you tomorrow the pages from the book, you know, in our presentation tomorrow, which is a scientific presentation on this book and the references for the spectroscopic analysis. And the reason I'm talking about the spectroscopy is a lot of people heard my presentation back in 1995, and they said, Dave, then this is how you get the metal. Because what the Russians do is they take the powder, they mix it with strontium carbonate as an internal buffer, and they place it on the electrode, and they start the burn. Now, in the United States, in most Western countries, they do 10 to 12 second burns. They turn on the arc, they let it burn for 12 seconds, and then they turn it off and read the results. And they assume that in the 12 seconds, every element in the sample reads. Well, the Soviet Academy of Sciences, who produces about 75% of the world's platinum group elements, says that the way you do it, and this is referenced by the Vernadsky Institute for Precious Metal Research in the Soviet Union, which we don't have anything like that in the Western countries at all. This is a government-funded Precious Metal Research Institute. Anyway, they put it on there, strike the arc. They let it burn for the first 15 seconds, but they don't open the slit. They don't read what we read. And after 10 seconds, nothing reads. And they go 20 seconds, 30 seconds, and the arc's still burning, 40 seconds, 50 seconds, 60 seconds, still not reading anything, 70 seconds, and then they open the slit at 70 seconds. Not 10 seconds like we burn it, but 70 seconds. And at 70 seconds, they open the slit. And then it begins to read. Palladium reads first. Then I believe it's either rhodium or platinum. I believe it's platinum. Then palladium. Then rhodium. Then ruthenium. Then iridium. And then osmium. Anyway, the elements come off. And I'm not sure that's the exact order. I mean, I'll show it to you on the paper tomorrow. But they come off in the series of their vaporization temperatures. So the lowest boiling temperature material comes off first, and then the next higher one comes off next, and it has to be totally out before the next one will get hot enough. It burns off, and it'll vaporize. And then it's gone, then the next one will get hot enough, and it comes off. And they actually come off all by themselves as specific elements. And they refer to it as fractional vaporization. That's the term they use for it. Nobody in this country even knew about this, hardly at all. There's very few people who are doing any type of analysis similar to this. Anyway, if you take a standard and put in on there something that is being used today in these laboratories and the ones right here in this area doing analysis for high-tech companies, and you put iridium or rhodium and platinum on the machine and you turn on the arc, it will read in the first 10 seconds and then quits reading. And then it doesn't read until 70 seconds. And then at 70 seconds, about 90% more reads, 90% of the sample reads then, where 10% of it read in the first 10 seconds. 90% of it reads at 70 seconds, and then they all come off in the sequence they're supposed to. In other words, the people who are doing analysis for you right now in commercial laboratories are only reading about 10% of the material you're using for standard. Only 10% of these precious elements are actually there in that first 10 seconds. And they assume it's all. So we took our unknown substance that we suspected had these elements, and we mix it up with the strontium carbonate, put it on the electrode, and we start burning it. The first 10 seconds, basically nothing red. Nothing. Then it went quiet. And there's nothing reading at all other than just it's called background noise from the arc, but that's kind of like grass on the film. Nothing reads at 20 seconds, 30 seconds, 40 seconds, 50 seconds, 60 seconds, 70 seconds, and then at about 70 seconds, here comes palladium. And palladium reads. After 70 seconds, at about 85 seconds, here comes the next element, the next element, the next element. They come off in numbers of like 290,000 counts against a 10,000 count background. Now, this isn't a little bit. This is a whole bunch of materials there. And these are elements that are more valuable than even gold. And they're there in these kind of numbers, and nobody knows about it. And I said, wow, you know, this is pretty neat information, isn't it? So I said, well, let's burn this material to 69 seconds. And let's stop. It's 69 seconds, right before these elements start to vaporize and come off and read. And let's take, you know, and you go over to the carbon electrode, and you can't even see the metal's all down in the carbon, you know, soaked in with it. And you have to dig the carbon apart to find the little bead of metal, and it's down in the carbon. You dig it out. I said, this is 1 second from reading. Let's clean all the carbon off this little bead, and let's send it for, I'll tell you what, let's send it for neutron activation analysis. Let's don't even mess with electron analysis, you know, the outer shells. Let's go right inside that nucleus itself. Now, that surely neutron activation is going to find these elements, right? So we send it for neutron activation analysis. Now, this is real expensive. It's hard to get analysis done this way, but you have to go to one of the national laboratories to get the work done because they have to have the neutron capabilities. Anyway, when they did the analysis of it, no precious elements detected. I said, wait a minute. This is 1 second from reading these elements. And we're reading every spectral line, not just some lines, but every spectral line that's supposed to be there is coming off. And you're telling me 1 second before that you can't find anything? I said, look, we're not telling you what's going on. We're just telling you there's no precious elements here. I said, guys, there's something wrong. There's something really wrong. This bead is virtually pure precious elements. And you're telling me there's no precious elements here. Then we got a real serious problem. Anyway, I went back and I spent probably a total of probably 14 months just making up standards and rerunning standards. We ran standards with all the precious elements in exactly the amounts we're reading these in our unknown substance. We added all the potential interfering elements that could cause problems in the various spectral ranges and the various emission lines just to check and be absolutely certain that this wasn't interfering. Now, this analysis is being done not on a 1.5-meter instrument, but a 3.5-meter instrument, which is a big, big, you know, machine, which gives you a lot of capabilities you can't get with a smaller instrument. In fact, you don't find them this big in most universities. It's a really big machine. And the fellow doing the analysis for me, his name was Siegfried Brimmer. He was in North Scottsdale. And Siegfried Brimmer was a German fellow with a real, real German accent still. And, you know, I can't even speak in a German accent, but it's real hard to understand. He says, Dave, he says, these elements are not there. He says, 10 seconds is all you have to do. And he says, the only way I'll do this is you got to pay me to do it all. You got to pay me to change my machine. You got to make the atmosphere control chamber so the carbon electrodes don't burn up, which you got to shield it from air. We had to do a little, the shielding gas around it. We had to put these line slit positions in his machine. We had to buy all the commercial standards. We had to buy the PK blenders for him to blend the strontium carbonate with it. All the things that the Soviets said had to be done, we had to do for him, and then pay him for his time to make the changes to his machine. Then when finally read, Bremer all of a sudden wouldn't talk to us anymore. Because he said it wouldn't read, and then when it read, he said, I got to look this over on my own. So he wouldn't let us in his laboratory for probably 3-4 weeks while he replicated all this on his own. And when he finally was comfortable that it was these elements, then he would allow us back at his lab again. But he said, Dave, he said, this is phenomenal. He said, nobody knows this. In fact, Brimmer actually took this information to Germany, and he was published in the spectroscopic journals over there in Germany that he had made the discovery of these precious elements in Arizona in natural materials. And that was so astounding that they published it in the journals over in Germany. Fortunately, it never got into English, so most people over here never read it or found out about it. But he took full credit for making the discovery, even though I paid for everything, and, you know, but I didn't have him sign an agreement. What I want to tell you people is just because you can prove they're there that's just a piece of the puzzle. Still, you've proven they're there, but you still have a whole lot of additional work to do. So for you people who have interest in mining operation or investments in mining or interested in metallurgy, let me tell you, that's just a little piece. That's just one step out of about 20 steps you've got to take. The next thing I did is I went to a PhD analytical chemist. The fellow's name was John Sickafoose. John was a PhD analytical chemist trained at Iowa State University. Now, for you people who don't know, to become a PhD analytical chemist at one of the nation's leading metallurgical schools, like the facility where they have the Department of Energy Research Facility at Ames, Iowa, this is considered to be one of the better metallurgical schools in the United States. He's a PhD analytical chemist. He's the guy you take something to and says, "What is it?" And he will physically separate everything in there and give it to you in little piles. The sodium's in this pile, the strontium's in this pile, the molybdenum's in this pile, the titanium's in this pile, you know, the iron's in this pile. Everything's in their own separate piles. But when I went to John, he says, "Dave," and I just met him, you know, he said, "Dave, I've heard this story about these platinum group elements in our natural materials here in Arizona. I'm a native also." And he said, "You know, the only thing I have to sell is my reputation." And he says, "I'll tell you what, I will do the work at no charge until I can give you a written report. At the time I give you a written report, then I'll give you a bill." I says, "John, as long as I get the written report and I have the answers, you know, it's fine with me. Start to work on it." So John started working on it. Now, he didn't tell me how long he thought it was going to take. A year and a half later, John has been working on it every day, 5 days a week, for a year and a half. And he is separating exactly the same amount that the spectroscopist was getting that supposedly was in this material. The spectroscopist said there was 4 to 6 ounces per ton of palladium. He said there was 12 to 14 ounces per ton of platinum. There was a neighborhood of 12 to 14 ounces per ton of gold. There was 800 ounces per ton of rhodium. There was 1,200 ounces per ton of iridium. I think it was 400 ounces per ton of ruthenium. Anyway, big numbers. When John finished the separations, he had the exact amounts weighed out and separated. He said, "Dave, that's pure rhodium. Dave, that's pure iridium." But he said, "Dave, there's a real problem here. As a spectroscopist who is trained in metallurgy, separations, when I finish my separation, the last step I'm supposed to do is take that material and send it to a spectroscopist for confirmation of what it is. And when I send the rhodium for confirmation that it is pure rhodium," he said, "they tell me it's silicon aluminum." And he said, "Dave, that's not silicon aluminum." I said, "John, now what do you do?" He says, "Dave, I have no idea." But he says, "What we've got to do is a research project. We've got to actually learn what's going on, why this is different from the commercial rhodium. Because if I buy commercial rhodium and put it through this procedure, it comes out right where the rhodium comes out. And if I buy iridium and put it through the procedure, it comes out right where the iridium comes out. And if I put gold in the procedure, it comes out where the gold comes out." And he says, "I can blend it with your material, and it comes out with your material at this very same point as your material comes out." And he says, this is what I'm saying it is. But he said, "The machine says it's not this." In fact, the very last step, you separate this material, and you oxidize it at 800 degrees, and hydrogen reduce it, and it's supposed to be the pure element in this quartz tube, you know, inside, no air getting to it. And what happened to all these elements, when you heat them in the tube, instead of gold being a yellow metal, it was a white powder. And the rhodium, instead of being a silvery gray metal, is a light gray powder. And the platinum and iridium are actually look like iron or dark gray. You know, and this didn't make any sense. It's absolutely preposterous that this is the observation we're getting, and when we send it for analysis, there's no gold in the gold. The rhodium has no rhodium in it. So John says, well, Dave, I was trained at Iowa State University. And this is the Department of Energy. Now, these guys are good. They're really good, Dave. He says, let's take the rhodium and let's dissolve it in hydrochloric acid, which there's procedures to get it solubilized so it'll go into hydrochloric acid. It won't dissolve in hydrochloric acid, but you can get it solubilized and put it into hydrochloric acid. And then evaporate it down to salt crystals. And he said, let's just form rhodium trichloride. We evaporate down to this ruby red color. And this ruby red color is really an indicative color. It's kind of a rose red. And usually there's a woman in the audience wearing a blouse this color, but I don't see one here. But it's a rosy red, a real distinctive color, a rosy red color. And this is where rhodium got its name, from the rose color of its chloride salts. Rhodium was named after the rose color of its chloride salts. So we made these distinctively, you know, colored salts. We send them to the Department of Energy. And the Department of Energy, you know, analyzes and sends it back a report. The only thing they could detect was chlorine. Now, chlorine is a gas. This was crystalline, a rosy red crystal. There has to be something other than chlorine gas, or it can't be a crystal. But all the Department of Energy could see was chlorine. And so we call them up. We said, look, there has to be something else here. There has to be an element here. It could be an alkali metal. It can be an alkaline earth. It can be other metal that doesn't have to be the ones we want. But there has to be something here binding the chlorine to make it crystalline. Well, they got really angry. They got really upset that we were sitting in this material. It was dumbfounding them. They could not explain what it was. They knew it was wrong. They knew there was more to the report than this, but they couldn't tell us what it was. And the only guy who could do the spectroscopy for us was Brimmer, and that was using procedures that I had developed with him, which doesn't serve as an independent confirmation of John's chemistry. You got to have somebody who is independent of you do the work. So it was really frustrating for poor John. John says, Dave, the only thing I have to sell is my reputation. And I tend to take on jobs that nobody else will take because I can solve problems, whether it's Motorola or Sperry or who has the problem. If they come to me, I'll solve the problem for them. And he does that. I mean, that's what he does for a living. Well, I brought him a problem he couldn't solve. He said, Dave, we're just going to have to do more research on this. We're going to have to go further into it. Well, a friend of mine up in San Francisco, his name was Jim Christensen. He works with one of the big investment houses up there, had been calling me on a regular basis, following my progress and what was going on. And Jim Christensen told me, he said, Dave, the people at General Electric are actually working with fuel cells. And they're doing fuel cell work. They've built the fuel cells for the Apollo and Gemini space program. And he said, these people, you know, have worked with rhodium and iridium and platinum in fuel cells. Why don't we contact them and talk to them about this? So I called them. We set up an appointment to go back and visit with them back in, I don't remember where they were now, GE. Anyways, I think it was near New Jersey someplace. Anyway, we took a flight back there. John Sickafoos and myself went back to meet with them. And, of course, when we came in the meeting, there was like nine people representing GE there, three attorneys, you know, and their problem was is a lot of people call GE and then meet with them and then claim that GE stole their knowledge from them, and GE will have to pay them to settle the litigation because they're better off paid than to divulge what they're doing. And so what they wanted us to do is agree that we wouldn't sue them, we wouldn't come after them, that what we were bringing them was voluntary, and a whole bunch of legal mumbo-jumbo they put us through. But I say, fine, no problem. I just want to talk to you about it. So we signed all our documents, and the attorneys left, and we got on to talking about chemistry. And a fellow there by the name of Tony LeConte. Tony LeConte was the precious metal chemist at General Electric. And I began to talk to Tony about this stuff, you know, how it reacted, what was going on. And he says, well, I'll tell you what. He said, why don't you just make a bunch of this rhodium chloride and send it to me? He said, I'll mount it in a fuel cell. And we'll see if it works. He said, I won't send it for analysis. I don't care what it is. If you want me to, I'll just build a fuel cell. We'll put it in and see if it works. He says, you know, then once we know, then we'll talk about, you know, paying for it. And I said, well, that sounds like a good idea. Well, the amount he wanted, though, was going to take us about 7-8 months to make in the laboratory. It was quite a bit of material. He was kind of flipping about, you know, just making me this amount. But I think he was needing like 55 grams or something like this. Well, that's a lot of material on the scale that we were making in the laboratory. Anyway, we went back, went to work making this rhodium chloride for his fuel cell. And in the meantime, GE sold the fuel cell division United Technologies. United Technologies had the sulfuric acid or technology, but they wanted the solid polymer electrolyte technology that GE had. It's lighter and more efficient. The only kicker that is the solid polymer technology, you have to have pure hydrogen. It doesn't work on hydrocarbon fuels like you buy, alcohol or something to run a car. You would put alcohol in it, and then you take the hydrogen away from the alcohol and run the fuel cell. Well, the solid polymer electrolyte technology doesn't work well in this particular application because it poisons the platinum. And so it wasn't considered a commercially viable technology, even though it was the best for the space program. It was the lightest weight and the easiest to build. It didn't work in commercial applications. And because the space program wasn't doing real well at that time and looked like the commercialization of the solid polymer electrolyte technology wasn't ever going to happen, GE sold the technology to United Technologies. All fuel cell people working at GE then had to go over and work with United Technologies. Well, they were not the senior fuel cell people now when they got over to United Technologies. They had just been moved in out of a new company. And so they agreed that they had to work for at least 4 months or 6 months, something like that, and then they could leave. So as soon as Tony LeConte could leave, he left. And he went with a fellow he had met named Jose Giener. And Jose Giener had a fuel cell company up in Waltham, Massachusetts. And it's basically all of the GE fuel cell people went with Tony up to Waltham, Massachusetts to work with. The gentleman's shaking his head here. He must know these people anyway. So the people then, by the time I got the material produced and came back, they weren't there, so I had to go to Waltham, Massachusetts to find where the fuel cell people were. And they said, oh yeah, but now we're an independent company. We can actually contract with you and make the fuel cells. We're building fuel cells for the Department of Defense. We're building fuel cells for electronics companies. They put them on repeaters on the top of mountaintops and all, so they got power sources in remote areas. We'll build a fuel cell here under contract. So they signed the confidentiality agreements with me and everything, and they said, we'll just mount your alleged rhodium alternative material on carbon, press it into electrodes, make a fuel cell, put hydrogen in it, and we'll see, if it works. So as received, they sent our material for analysis. And the rhodium contained no rhodium. But they went ahead and mounted on the carbon. We're paying for it, so they take our money. They mounted on the carbon and did the fuel cell test. But the crazy thing about it is when they ran the fuel cell, it worked. And it did what only rhodium would do on carbon. Now, this kind of dumbfounded them. They said, gosh, this is pretty slick. We've been looking for something that will work other than the platinum group elements, and you just bought us something that appears to work. So they ran it through all this testing and cycling and the power up and power down and, all these things. Anyway, after a couple of weeks, they stopped the fuel cell operation, take the electrodes out, and now send them back to the lab that said there was no rhodium in our sample. And now there's over 12% rhodium on the electrode. Now, this really blew them away. They said, now, wait a minute. As received, there was no rhodium, and now there's 12% rhodium in the electrode. Where did the rhodium come from? And I said, look, the rhodium has been there all along. The problem is they were using X-ray to do the analysis. And by then I had learned a little bit. The X-ray is the preferred method of analysis because it doesn't destroy the sample. You can do an analysis to the sample. Well, the X-ray wavelength is about 15 angstroms. That's the length of the wave. So it hits the sample here and hits the sample here. It has to hit the sample twice or it can't see it. If your particle size is less than 15 angstroms, it's called X-ray amorphous. Your machine can't see it. Well, we had come to the conclusion that our material was monoatomic. Not diatomic, not trimeric, but it was actually monoatomic. And this is the way the Russians said it had to be purified as monoatomic material. The kicker was, how do you get it back to metal from the monoatomic material? Anyway, we now know that if you put it on carbon and apply an electrical potential to it over a period of weeks, it becomes metallic. The atoms actually on the surface of the carbon will migrate to each other and form metal-metal bonds and grow little metallic clusters on the carbon. And now you put X-ray to it and bang, bang, it hits it twice. There's rhodium. The rhodium is now mysteriously on the carbon where it wasn't on the carbon when we brought it to them. Now, we knew this. They didn't know this, but we knew this. But I told them generally what was going on, and they said, Dave, nobody in the U.S. understands this. And to our knowledge, nobody in the world understands this. And they said, Dave, if you're the first one to understand this, you can patent it. So I said, well, what do I want to patent it for? They said, well, to protect yourself, protect your technology. Well, I guess they do this all the time in their profession. They patent everything. I wasn't interested in patenting it, but they said, Dave, you really ought to consider it. Come to Washington, D.C., and we'll introduce you to our patent attorney. I said, who's your patent attorney? He said, his name is Al Briner, Briner & Briner, Washington, D.C., or just outside of Washington, D.C. And so I said, okay, you got my attention. I'll go with you. You'll meet the guy and see what he has to say. But he told me all about it. He said, Dave, this is the procedure. This is what it costs. This is what we got to do. Well, Al Briner got together with my attorney in Phoenix, and they talked about it, and they decided we were going to patent this. But to patent it, we had to have specific definitions. We had to describe it in detail for the patent. Okay, well, by this time, there was a company up in Vancouver, Canada. This came forward with some money, and they said, Dave, we'd like to put up the money to patent it. And we'll become a partner of yours. We'll put up all the money. And I said, the only way I'll get involved with you, because agriculture was turning a little sour, and I wasn't making the money to keep supporting this thing, they said, Dave, we'll put up like the $1 million that you got to have to keep this thing going, this patenting process, but we want a partnership. And I said, well, the only way I'll get involved with you is you can't talk about this. You can't say anything to the general public about it because you're a public company. And you cannot talk to your financing partners in London or anything. You just, this is just an investment you have, and that's it. No more. No more said about it. Well, they said, fair enough. We've got 30 other investments other than you. Well, within 3 years, all their other 30 investments were belly up. They weren't making any money. And all they had was us. Well, come to find out, they were getting their money from Legal & General Assurance in London. I don't know if you know who Legal & General Assurance is, but there's three large financial groups over there. One's Prudential, one's Legal & General Assurance. If you go to London, you go through downtown London, here's whole city blocks all torn up and you know, excavated out for a downtown parking area. And a new skyscraper going to be built that says, this project funded by Legal & General Assurance. They literally have billions of dollars to invest every year, big financial group. And the president of this investment group had put the money in this group in Vancouver. Well, now he's starting to look bad with his company back. Legal & General is starting to look at their president kind of funny. You lost a bunch of money. They've lost these other 30 companies. The only thing they got is something he won't talk about. And they kept telling him, well, this is really important. This is really important. So the president, his name was Peter Simon, comes to Vancouver, and they bring Peter down to meet us, and Peter meets with us, and he says, you know, you guys are really on the edge, aren't you? You're doing something kind of far out. He says, it wouldn't be good for me to evaluate this. I need to bring in an expert. I need to bring somebody in who knows what he's talking about, somebody who worked with these metals and knows what they are. So I said, well, if I approve him, and he'll sign a confidentiality agreement, and any report he writes is given to us first before it's given to Legal & General, and then if we approve of its release, then it can be released. Fair enough? Fair enough. They didn't really have any choice. They had to get this thing resolved. So a fellow by the name of Brian Lerwell, who for years was a senior chemical refiner for Engelhard Industries. And for you people who don't know, there's three precious metal companies in the world, Johnson Matthey, Engelhard, and Hoboken Overpelt in Brussels. Okay? Those are the, and besides the Soviet government. Anyway, the Engelhard is a subsidiary of Johnson Matthey. They have the different boards of directors, but they have the same ownership. Anyway, Engelhard sent this guy a notice that 1 year before he was to retire that he was let go. So he was a little bitter towards Engelhard. He's working with a company called the Leeds Group, just north of London. Anyway, he was contracted with Legal & General Assurance to come over and evaluate my work. So he comes to Phoenix. He spends about 2.5 weeks. He goes through all the lab separation procedures. He went to the GE fuel cell people, saw what they were doing, saw the results. He went to the mining property where we actually had traced it to a natural occurrence that we were getting the material from, watched the core drilling and sampling being done, talked to all the PhDs and the master's chemists and all who were involved with the laboratory. He wrote up an 18-page written report. The problem was, this was a rave review. It was such a good report that we actually got a little scared, people, because he said, you are talking about changing the precious metal industry. Precious metal industry that Johnson Matthey and Engelhardt control, you're talking about literally knocking it flat. They will not be able to dictate and set the prices like they do today once you're on the marketplace. But he said one thing to me in private. He said, Dave, Johnson Matthey will have to take you out. They will make you an offer that you will have to accept, and if you don't accept it, they will remove you from the situation. I think it's a little frightening. And I don't subscribe to people who have talk about conspiracy theories or, you know, the Illuminati and things like this. I really just try to stay off it. I don't want to get into that kind of subject. But when you get to checking, the same people who are on who own Johnson Matthey, who've been refiners for the Crown since 1850, they sit on the boards of directors of virtually every company in London. Any major company has the same people sitting on the boards. And therefore, any report that went back to the original investment group who was invested in us, it goes to their board of directors, and here are members of Johnson Matthey's board of directors sitting on their board. We're going to read this report. Before anyone else gets to see it, they're going to know about it. And it's not a report to be taken lightly, because Brian Lerwell was somebody pretty darn good in the industry. You know, he's somebody who should know what he's talking about. So he said, you know, we don't have all the answers for your work. We still have a lot of work that should be done. But he says, you have it. The rhodium is rhodium. The iridium is iridium. The platinum is platinum. The gold is gold. He said, I cannot explain why it isn't being spec'd by standard spectroscopic analysis, but if you could turn it into metal on a carbon electrode, we don't care. The implications are really serious. So when we read the report, my attorney says, Dave, you can't release this report. The report is too good. It's too good a report. Well, you say, yeah, this makes a good story. Why can't we see the report? Well, anybody who wants to see the report can contact me in Phoenix, and I will show them the report. I just can't let you have a copy of it. But you can read it, you can see a signature, and you get Brian Lerwell's number, and you can call Brian in the Leeds Group in London and say, did you meet with Dave Hudson? Did you write a report? Is this your signature? And he'll say yes. So I just can't give you, and I can't show it to you on the video, but I can sure let you come to Phoenix and read the report. It just would really hurt Legal and General Assurance's feelings if they found out a report they paid for, paid all his money for the guy to fly from London, come out here, fly all the U.S., do the evaluation, write the report, and then they never got to see it. And then I'm showing it to the general public. So anyway, it's a report to be taken seriously, but it's not something I can show on the video here. Anyway, but I do have a copy. If anybody is serious and wants to see it, I do have copies of it. I also have the letters from John Sickafoos over the years written to me about it. I have the letters from a gentleman that I was referred to by the patent office. The patent office said, Dave, you file this patent, you must characterize the material. You must define the weight losses, weight gains, chemistries. Everything must be detailed in the patent. So in 1986, we filed U.S. and worldwide patents on, and this is just a name we made up, orbitally rearranged monatomic elements, ORMIS. We also filed patents on orbitally rearranged monatomic elements in the S state. And that was a superconducting light state. In other words, the atom by itself had characteristics, but when you put a lot of the atoms together, they had other characteristics that the single atom didn't have. One of these was levitation. The material would levitate. The material would lose and gain weight. And this material was weird. And so in the characterization of it, we included our graphs and our charts and all of the studies of the weight in with the patent. And the patent was on Orms, and it was on S. Orms. Now, I didn't know that any patent on superconductivity had to be approved by the Department of Defense to get a patent. I didn't know this. I mean, I'm just a dumb cotton farmer. I mean, I'm just first time I ever applied for a patent. So, the law says that you apply for a patent and you have a year to apply for your worldwide patents. But before you go to patent pending, which is patent applied for, is what they call it. Before you go to patent pending, if it's a strategic area like superconductivity, then it must be approved by the Department of Defense before it can go to patent pending. The only thing is, the patent office didn't realize it was on superconductivity. And so they didn't say anything. And after about 11 and a half months, we tell them, okay, now we're going to file the worldwide patents in every country in the world other than the Soviet Union and Red China. Every other country. You wouldn't believe the list of countries there are out there, people. There's countries, oh. Anyway, everyone has to have a file. Everyone's got to pay a fee to file it. Anyway, in 1987, we filed U.S. and worldwide patents. And they said, wait a minute, we won't let you file worldwide. We have just showed it to the Department of Defense, and they have said, no, you can't file worldwide. I said, wait a minute. We've only got like 3 weeks to get them filed worldwide. And this guy, Palms and Fleischman up in Utah, had filed their information relating to cold fusion. You all remember that? About 1987, 88. Anyway, it was right in the middle of my patenting procedure. And I said, I got to keep that original date because Palms and Fleischman are using palladium electrodes and they're using lithium deuterate as their electrolyte. And this white crud that's forming on the palladium is palladium in this state. It emits heat. It's a nuclear reaction. And I said, I've got to have my patent in place to protect me. So they go back to the Department of Defense, talk to them, come back and override the Department of Defense. And they say, Dave, you can file your patent worldwide. Well, my name suddenly became mud with the Department of Defense. You know, they don't like to be overridden very much. And so they all of a sudden said, well, you may have patents filed, but you're not going to get them granted in the U.S. without our approval. So they sent a gentleman out from Virginia who flew out to Phoenix, wanted to meet with me. And my attorney, Al Olson, and myself went to meet with him. This guy, I hate to say it, but he was dressed in a black suit. And he had sunglasses, but he wasn't wearing them. They were in his pocket, and it was evening. But, gosh, Al's paranoid, doesn't it? Anyway, I don't remember the guy's name right now. The fellow we met with. But he told us that what they required is that I would have to take gold, and they picked gold out of all the elements. I mean, I had platinum, palladium, rhodium, iridium, ruthenium, osmium, silver, and gold. They picked gold. Now, gold is the toughest one. Gold is the most difficult one to get to the monatomic state. But they picked gold, certainly, and they said, Dave, what we want you to do is go to an independent laboratory. I said, well, I've got a Ph.D. analytical chemist that's worked with me for 9 years. And they said, no, that guy's contaminated. He's worked with you. You've got to go to a totally independent laboratory. The laboratory has no association with you whatsoever and pay them to do the production of the monatomic white gold from yellow gold. They said, if you do that, then we'll let you go to patent pending. I said, okay, all right, I'll do that. So I said, what lab would qualify? What would you accept? What lab's good enough for you? And he says, well, you pick the lab. And I said, well, how about Argonne National Laboratories? United States Government National Laboratories. Is that good enough? He said, yeah, that's fine. Of course, what could he say? It was their lab. So I contacted Roger Popel, head of ceramics and superconductivity at Argonne National Laboratories just outside of Chicago. And I made an appointment, went back, met with him, and told him what we were doing. Showed him all the physics and everything. And he says, Dave, he said, this is incredible. He said, you know why you succeeded at this when nobody else could? And I said, why? And he said, because you're too stupid to know it was impossible. And so you did it anyway. But he said, Dave, do me a favor. Don't ever call me on an open line. Do not ever send anything in writing that you don't wrap with aluminum foil when you put it in the envelope. I said,
Roger, why? And he says, because this place is full of spies. The national labs are full of spies. He says, anything you send to me has to be handled this way. Anyway, he said, Dave, I'll do this for you. And so we wrote it all up. What we need him to do is take yellow gold and, following our procedures and our patent, make the white powder of gold from the yellow gold. And anyway, he said, Dave,